Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Lauren Miles.
Hello.
Hello. This week, we have got interviews galore. There's Leslie Headland and Mani Jacinto talking about new Star Wars show, The Acolyte, Shana Night Shyamalan and M. Night Shyamalan, and Dakota Fanning on The Watched. Richard Linklater is talking about his new film, Hitman, and we'll also have Viggo Mortensen and Vicky Creeps talking about The Dead Don't Hurt. Plus, we'll be reviewing that show and those films, and also reviewing Bad Boys Ride or Die. But first, Lauren, have you been watching anything else this week? Or have you been to any film-related events or anything?
Well, I actually watched for the first time The First Omen, which I didn't see when it came out in cinemas. But I thought that was really good. And also, I'm kind of with the people that came out of the screenings and said, how is this a 15? Because of, you know, kind of the gory childbirth bits, and those were a bit disturbing. So, yeah, I'm kind of with them on that.
Yes, I reviewed that on the podcast, and I was a fan as well, and also was disturbed and questioned the 15 rating there, but there you go. Until you mentioned it, I didn't realise I was actually on Disney Plus, so if you didn't catch that at the cinema, I would say that is worth checking out, definitely. And to be honest, I haven't really been watching much this week besides the stuff we're talking about, but I did revisit the first Inside Out in preparation for the second one coming out soon, which is just, it is a stone cold classic in my opinion. I just love that film, and always spot something small new about it whenever I watch it. And also had a kind of a rewatch of Jurassic Park as well, which is a film I do revisit relatively often. But this was the first time I'd watched it with my son, who we kind of felt was just about the right age to watch it. And didn't seem to be quite as groundbreaking an experience as it was for me as when he watched it, but he seemed to like it. And every time I watch Jurassic Park, I just love it. It's easily just one of my most enjoyable films, and definitely one of my most pivotal cinema experiences.
What was his opinion on the VFX?
He's a bit too young to sort of that, but he seems pretty convinced. So I suppose it's one of those things that it's quite slow moving. It's sort of a ridiculous thing to say about Jurassic Park, really, but I suppose it takes a little bit of time to establish it. And then obviously it's a complete roller coaster once it gets going. But maybe to the younger audience, like, because obviously when I saw it at the cinema when it came out, obviously we'd never really seen anything like that before. But now in the years since, we've obviously had like Walking with Dinosaurs, and kids have that sort of repurposed as Andy's Dinosaur Adventures on CBeebies and stuff. So like, just the idea of just seeing a massive dinosaur walking around isn't as groundbreaking. And we've also watched together the Prehistoric Planet, the Apple TV Plus series, which I love that series. And that just has absolutely amazing VFX. So I suppose it's never going to be as crazy seeing Jurassic Park for the first time as it was for us when we first saw it, or for me, sorry. I don't want to group you into my age bracket, but yes, it's still stands up as a film. I just absolutely love it, and I still just have like hairs standing up on the back of your neck at the set pieces, and like the T-Rex one obviously in particular, and it just always takes me back. So I'm always happy to have a Jurassic Park revisit. But on to the new releases now, and first up, it's A Murder Mystery in a Galaxy Far, Far Away.
Last night, a Jedi was murdered.
The Jedi justify their galactic dominance in the name of peace.
But that peace is a lie.
So this is The Acolyte, which is the newest installment in the ever-expanding Star Wars universe. Here, we're jumping back 1,000 or so years before the time of The Phantom Menace to explore the world of the High Republic, which has been a staple of Star Wars lore, but hasn't really been depicted on screen before. And also what's different about this show is that it's something of a murder mystery, which we also haven't really seen in Star Wars. And it's created by showrunner Leslie Headland, who was behind the Netflix series Russian Doll. And before we review the show, we're going to hear from Leslie and one of the stars of the show, Mani Jacinto, from when they sat down with senior entertainment writer Bradley Russell last week. And be aware that the interview does contain mild spoilers for the first episode, which is already on Disney Plus now. But if you haven't seen it yet and want to go in completely cold, now's your chance to pause and check the time codes in the show notes and jump ahead to where you need to get to. But if you're staying with us, here's that interview now with Leslie Headland and Mani Jacinto.
Leslie, I kind of want to start with you because we're in the High Republic, which is an era that maybe some fans maybe aren't as familiar with. What are the differences between the High Republic and other Star Wars eras, and why did you gravitate towards it for the story you're telling?
Well, I actually, when I first pitched the project, I suggested that it take place before Phantom Menace. It just felt, because we were telling a totally original story, meaning it wasn't connected to the Skywalker saga or the Empire and Resistance and Rebellion, I think in order to draw audiences in and to create a fresh entry point for audiences, meaning you don't need to know a lot about Star Wars in order to watch the show, it felt natural to move back in time and set the story there.
Like building something like completely fresh and new in Star Wars is a rare opportunity. What was, I guess, your starting point, the first idea you clung to, the first thing you pictured in your head?
The first thing I pictured in my head was a conflict between two sisters. I have some family drama in the Hedlund family. And one of the things that occurred to me was most of the Star Wars films are about some sort of family conflict or family dynamic, whether it be chosen family like Master Apprentice, or it be husband and wife, brother and sister, father and son. It seemed to me that it would be interesting to have two sisters who are on opposite ends of the spectrum. In my own life, I feel a particular way, and I have a family member that is on the opposite end of the spectrum. And I thought one day, well, she feels like she's really right, and I feel like I'm really right. Mm. So having that play out in the Star Wars universe, I thought would be really interesting.
And Manny, I've seen the first four episodes, and Kamir seems like very guarded. It's almost very quite hard to get a read on him. So I'm interested to know, how was he pitched to you?
It was pitched as almost like a math problem. We kind of hashed it out. I mean, I remember Leslie, she couldn't say much about the project, but she very much just pitched this character and, you know, how can we have like maybe a more lighthearted, perhaps even like a lower status type of character that kind of navigates through these dominant powers. And yeah, that just piqued my interest because, you know, I mean, it'd be great to play a Jedi or somebody that wields a lightsaber, but how does like a normal person kind of weasel his way around this universe.
And the Acolyte as well, like the opening, like for me was so shocking, almost like threw out the rule book a little bit. Like, I guess for both of you, how does that sort of set the tone for what's to come?
I just felt like with the cold open, especially with a new story, that you just have to, go hard. You have to say, yes, like the Jedi are going to take some L's. You're not going to know who the good guys and the bad guys are.
Yeah.
And it's going to feel very visceral. And even if you already know it's going to happen, like it doesn't have to be a big gotcha moment. It just has to be a moment where the emotional and the physical, meaning the fights, melt together. And I think Carrie Ann, not just being an action legend, is also a phenomenal actress. So she was able to really play all those beats within the fight, as well as, of course, her death scene.
And you very much have noted this, like having Trinity in Star Wars, it really sets the tone of like what the audience should expect.
Yeah.
You know, like it's, oh, this isn't going to be a type of Star Wars that we've seen before. It's going to be a very more physical, you just set a completely different tone once you see Trinity's face and you set that action.
Right. Yes, away. I begged Carrie Ann to do it.
Yeah. It's
and she was very much like, I don't really care about Star Wars, but my son and my husband do, so
yes,
I'll do it.
And Manny, we see early on that Kamir supports Amanda Lesenberg's character, May. Can you speak a little to the sort of dynamic there?
He obviously has his initial philosophy and he has to help May get through this this mission in order to appease like this master that she's currently under, and in order for him to survive, he has to just please them both. But you know, at the end of the day, he's again a very selfish character. He's gonna do whatever it takes to either appease the Jedi or whatever this dark master has in store.
And one thing that really struck me when watching the show is like everything felt tactile. It felt very real. I guess that was important for you as a creator, but also I guess hugely beneficial for you as an actor as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that, again, it was just a wish fulfillment kind of thing. You know, when I watched the original trilogy, episodes 4 through 6, there was something about that tactileness that struck me as so interesting, like that a futuristic sci-fi fantasy story could be told in a world that kind of looked a little shitty. You know, like it just, it struck me as such an interesting dynamic even as a kid. Mm. So, you know, getting my shot to make a Star Wars, I thought, well, I definitely wanted to do practical sets. I don't want to shoot on the volume. I want to do puppetry in terms of the creatures. I want to use the type of lightsabers that you can actually duel with, mm-hmm. as opposed to utilizing, you know, sticks that then you put CGI in later. Or even the sequel lightsabers were so heavy that that affected the way that Daisy and Adam fought,
yes.
Because they wanted to have that practical lighting. So we had to ask the props department to create lightsabers that could be utilized the way, you know, Darth Maul and Qui-Gon Jinn use them, but they also had to light up for the practical lights effect. So
yes.
I have to thank the props department for making that happen.
And I believe I'm right in saying you had at least one writer in your writer's room who wasn't familiar with Star Wars, which for me feels like a really healthy approach, that sort of like different voices in a room. Can you point to an example where it made The Acolyte better?
I loved this note from her. She gave so much feedback. This one I really loved, which is in episode 3, we have the twins as children. You know, when you're totally world building in an episode, like you're just creating, mm-hmm. you know, you're like, here's a new world after, you know, 2 episodes. You're really intent on having everybody explain things and having everybody, you know, the kids just weren't talking like kids. They were talking like Star Wars characters.
Wow.
And she said, well, when I was a little kid, I just cared about how many cookies were going to be at something. And I thought, oh my God, thank you. Because I would have worried about all the world building and the Star Wars-ness of these children. And she was like, just humanized the characters or attempted to. Sometimes I was like, no, we're doing the Star Wars version of them.
And in terms of, Leslie, in terms of the lore and the world, what was the most interesting challenge or limitation about being in that High Republic era?
We don't have sort of that immediate iconography of stormtroopers, for example. You know, when you see a stormtrooper, you know you're in Star Wars. So in a way, defining the good guys and bad guys, you know, there were certainly parts of that iconography, like, I don't know, a helmeted bad guy, you know, definitely. Like lightsabers, you know, we had some things to fall back on, or not fall back on, but we got to utilize. So in a way it was harder, but in a way it was freeing and easier. And I think that, you know, that when audiences watch it, there will still be that wish fulfillment of seeing the Jedi in action, and that that's what we get to do, which I think the other Star Wars media, the Jedi are, you know, either the underdogs or some of the Disney Plus shows, you don't see them at all. So with the exception of the prequels, you get to see a lot of Jedi, you know, fighting adversaries. But unlike the prequels, they're at their height. They don't expect any sort of conflict. So again, it's all these little bits that were more freeing and then also were inhibiting. So it was just about picking and choosing.
So that was Leslie Headland and Manny Jacinto on The Acolyte. So just to set this up a little bit further, the main character we're following in this series is former Jedi Osha, played by Amandla Stenberg. Osha is still relatively young, but she's already left the Jedi Order and is drifting somewhat and is making a living as a mechnik, I think that's what they called it. She is kind of fixing ships. And to dip into, again, to minor spoilers that reveal very early on in this first episode, but Osha is set up for a Jedi murder because someone who looks and sounds just like her is killing off Jedis. So Jedi Master Sol, who's played by Lee Jung-jae of Squid Game, sets out to find her and investigate what's actually going on. But Lauren, so did you actually like this show? You've seen the first 4 episodes, haven't you? I've seen the first 2 as we speak now.
Yeah, they gave us the first 4. So that's, I believe, half of the show that I've seen. But I'm really liking it so far. I think my favourite thing about Star Wars is when it kind of goes beyond the binary light side, dark side, Jedi, Sith, and kind of looks at the Jedi Order and its kind of rigidity and emotionlessness and goes, is this actually that good? And we kind of do go into that here with Osha being a former Jedi, and she's got her reasons for that. And it's good that they kind of delve more into the morally grey areas of Star Wars. And Lee Jung-jae, who you mentioned as Master Sol, I think his performance is really good. He's a bit of a, if you like your Star Wars, he's very similar to Qui-Gon Jinn, Liam Neeson's character in The Phantom Menace, in that he's kind of a less conventional Jedi that the rest of them think is, you know, a little bit strange.
Yeah, he's very much in that mold, isn't he? And like I say, I've only seen the first two at this point, which are kind of up on Disney Plus now as well, when by the time you listen to this. But I actually really liked it as well. Like, I didn't know a huge amount about it going in. I'm not someone who's really read like the Star Wars novels or anything like that, so I'm not hugely familiar with the High Republic. But I like the fact that we were removed from a lot of what we know about Star Wars, and away from the characters especially. Like, so the world still feels very recognisably Star Wars. Obviously, you have Jedis walking around, there's lightsabers, there's droids, there's random aliens kind of popping up, there's obviously all kind of spaceships, but it feels like, so far, again, from what I've seen, we're not really connected to the Skywalker family or anything like that. I liked feeling like I was exploring a different corner of the world compared to what we have seen before. And I thought it looked pretty good as well. I thought the VFX were pretty good. And I always like it when you get these prosthetics and puppetry, and when things feel a bit practical. They seem to know what people want from Star Wars, I think. They deliver on that, you know, in terms of the aliens and the practical effects and things. And I thought it was a pretty intriguing story. Again, not knowing too much about it. I knew there was this murder mystery element. And as Jordan kind of mentioned on last week's episode, it's kind of almost like a why done it more than a who done it. Yeah, after those two episodes, I was intrigued to carry on, definitely, even though I haven't watched three or four, which I have got. So I'm looking forward to catching up on those. But this is also like a risk for us that when you get these four episodes, then you've got to wait until the fifth one comes on TV. So
I do have to say, I think as you kind of get past those first two episodes, I agree with Jordan, it is more of a why done it. But I feel like it almost lets go of the mystery element too soon. And it kind of, you know, by the halfway point, you sort of know why. So I'm curious to see where that goes from there. But I am a bit disappointed that the mystery isn't sustained for a bit longer.
I was a bit surprised about it because I was almost confused by like the opening few scenes almost until you realise what's actually going on. Again, like I say, having not read up too much about it. And I never know whether you can call it a twist when it happens so early on in a show, but there is a kind of twist. But another thing which I liked about the episodes I saw is I did like the ragtag characters. So you've got a couple of other Jedi as well who are going along with Sol. There's Daphne Keane, who plays Jeki Lon, and Charlie Barnett, who plays Yord. I quite liked how you had these just contrasting figures in there. Just, I thought Daphne Keane was very funny. I just like seeing different kinds of Jedi, I suppose. Like, it's the first time, yeah, we've got to explore so many, really, isn't it, probably? I thought that they were nicely cast, and it was, yeah, an interesting... interesting to see some different Jedi, basically.
You get a lot of that just in the background of the show as well. Like, there's scenes in the Jedi Temple where you've just got so many different races of Jedi and so many different people wandering around. And there's clearly been a lot of thought and attention to detail put into just the environments of the show, which it always feels really good to watch.
And the second episode does end a bit abruptly, but we do there at the end meet the Wookiee Jedi as well. Kel Naka, I think his name is. Do episodes 3 and 4 deliver on more Wookiee Jedi?
A little bit, yeah. We do see more of Kel Naka. But if you like Wookiee Jedi, they are also in the animated shows.
Yes, that's another thing. I'm not up on the Clone Wars or anything like that. So I will check those out at one point. But if you fancy checking that out for yourself, that is The Acolyte. And the first two episodes are streaming now on Disney Plus, with new episodes dropping each Wednesday in the UK, Tuesday in the if you're in the US, but very early in the morning on Wednesday if you're in the UK. And next up, it's a very different kind of mystery.
You have 5 seconds before the door is sealed. 5, 4, 3, 2.
What is happening? What is this place?
I don't mean to scare you, but we haven't much time. It's not wise to keep them waiting. They'd be very interested in someone new.
It's a window on the other side. They come every night.
And they watch us.
What is that? What are they doing?
Applause. Or you mean it.
So this is The Watched, which is the first feature from Ashana Knight Shyamalan, who is the daughter of M. Night Shyamalan, and he is acting as a producer here, based on the book The Watchers by A.M. Shine, and it tells the story of an artist who finds herself trapped in a cabin in the middle of a forest surrounded by some ominous creatures. And before we review this film and discuss it further, we're going to hear from Shyamalan Night Shyamalan, M. Night Shyamalan, and star Dakota Fanning from when Lauren sat down with them in London last week.
How long have you been here?
I don't know.
You've never seen one.
No one sees one and survives.
They have come to our world for a reason.
I'm not supposed to be here, and I'm not staying here.
They allow us to live because we follow their rules.
You have broken too many.
So what was it like working on this film together?
I guess the first thing was it was really fun. We were, you know, we'd laugh and look at each other in the, you know, in Ireland and be cold and looking in, at each other in a forest in Ireland and be like, can't believe we're here doing this. It was full of energy. The crew was so lovely and really so much what I would have dreamed for her first project, and really honestly for any project that she would ever do. I would want that joy and love, but we'd all became very family. A family environment, but just not only just because we're family, but I think the whole crew had that feeling.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just so wonderful, I think, to have, as I was moving through the kind of emotional challenges of the experience, someone there who has felt the same things and could really kind of validate me without having to say much, that you kind of intuitively understood throughout the process where I was at. So that's just like a wonderful thing that I think not all first-time filmmakers get. So was feeling very grateful for that, particularly, yeah, when we were shooting in the forest and stuff. So yeah.
I heard that you did some second unit directing on this night.
Yes.
What was it like to work on it in that capacity and have Ashana be in charge?
It was great. It's so funny when you're doing something with a different intention, the same job that I've done my whole life, but with a different intention, which is I have to deliver for her. And not something that I came up with. It's something she came up with. So I want to do it in that would fulfill her. And so that created a kind of, I don't know, a different engine for me when I was directing those scenes for her. It was joyful because of it. I almost became a student again from the beginning, which is the dream that you start to see it in as new. I'm not using the tools that I normally have. I'm doing this for someone else. And so it was a real gift. I was just telling her how much it affected me, and actually I think changed me as a director for myself later for my film.
And what was it about the book by A.M. Shine, The Watchers, that made you both want to adapt it for the screen?
It's just a wonderful book to read. I think I had just felt like as a reader it was very, very scary. It scared me to read. And that felt very distinctive. And then it played in this kind of exact genre that I was interested in going into. I think you had given me the advice early on of like, pick a concept that you feel is sort of an unending well for you. And that for very much felt like the book, that there was sort of this expansive playground for me to work in. And it just felt it would be sort of a dream to put that into kind of film form.
Yeah, it has kind of at the base a kind of folklore underneath it, and that was all has always been something that's really interested Ashana. In fact, it's kind of her kind of calling. I think she loves world building, and when this book arrived and it had a very interesting structure to it and scary.
Yeah.
But at the base was this folklore underneath it that was growing like ivy, and I said, oh my gosh, this is kind of like the universe brought this thing to the table. Maybe you should read it.
And folk horror has been very popular in recent years in cinema. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that might be?
Yeah, all those kind of stories, we may have talked about this as well, like I think all those kind of stories are modes of talking about human emotion. And I think particularly now we are moving to like a more surrealist place to sort of explore emotions that are even more complex, I think, socially and things like that. So I think there's just this desire for an even deeper level of escapism there that folk horror seems to satisfy. And then the idea, like in my opinion, the idea that there kind of could be things existing in history and in this world, and that there's kind of more wonder in the world than we had thought previously is very exciting. And I think the collective consciousness is kind of like moving towards that mindset as well.
Yeah, folklore, I think, is because it's culturally embedded in our minds. It's almost like a grounded way to do fantasy and say, oh, this is what people used to believe, and maybe it's true. It's such to play in us because culture of it makes it sound like it's resonant and actually could be true. What if it was true? And this is the form that we misunderstood it, and now this is the way it looks. It's a great way to ground the scares and the fantasy.
Were there any other thriller or horror films that inspired you while you were making this?
Yeah, I was kind of inspired by The Witch and like the textures of The Witch and that kind of essence. So not kind of in the same genre, but we looked at Antichrist a lot as kind of a reference for what the forest might feel like. So it was very, very much those kind of things, those movies. I watched the movie Onibaba, which was hugely an influence for this movie as well. I think those movies all have this sense of nature being a kind of like supernatural force in the movie. So I was really looking to kind of how do I depict that in each frame and create this kind of feeling there.
Especially in the climax, you'll see, I can feel just as a viewer, kind of the old school Japanese like horror film influence on you. And it feels like that watching that.
Yeah, which I think, for me is, again, this kind of like presence of nature being there the whole time. And we think really in sound design and visuals, like that was a very important piece of this story.
What makes The Watch so suspenseful? And when it comes to the scares, how far have you gone with it?
A great part of the suspense is your own psychological journey through the movie, kind of trying to understand what you believe about what you're being told and what you don't believe and kind of questioning the circumstances. You're right with Mina in that journey, which is a very uneasy feeling. Yeah, for me, it's very much a suspense movie. It's about expectation. And drawing out kind of your fear of seeing something. So I think that leaves you with this like great sense of discomfort and fear as you move through it.
And when it comes to the creatures, when we finally do get to see them, how much of them is done practically and how much is visual effects?
It's all pretty much visual effects, kind of what you see in the movie. The basis of all of them is practical movement from dancers that we worked with and kind of choreographed pieces to throughout the movie. So it's a bit of both, that kind of like grounding in movement, but visually kind of digital.
What draws both of you to the thriller genre?
Well, I mean, for me, it was interesting as I was thinking about The Watched and when you were asking about the movement of scares, and when we talk about thriller, you know, it's a movement. Thriller's right in the middle between kind of drama, and then, you know, if you think of it as a staircase of drama, then mystery, then thriller, then supernatural thriller, and then horror, like the staircase of that adrenaline movement, that thriller's right in the middle, and it honors both the drama and the mystery on this side, and then you can tip it and go into the supernatural and the horror, which I think The Watch does. It kind of, you know, starts out as a drama, then a mystery. I mean, what is it? What's going on here? And then it moves to thriller for the base of the whole movie, and then dips wonderfully into horror at the end.
I think for me, it's just sort of like a means of exploring my own emotional landscape. I think I move through life, like experiencing it maybe as a thriller in some ways. Mm. Like I think I feel very anxious a lot and afraid of a lot of things. Playing in this thing is more so a language that's just sort of how I feel I need to speak in that language, and makes me feel a bit more, I think, control over those fears as I move through life.
And what made Dakota Fanning such a good casting for Mina, the main character, and what was it like to work with her?
She was wonderful. She was, very much someone who came to mind immediately as soon as I started writing the screenplay. And she's just, someone who's kind of, I think, resonated in my mind. And I think for our generation, she is this kind of essence of us that has existed with us, like, since we were young. And she sort of blossomed into this really, really kind of ethereal but grounded actress. And I just find her incredibly compelling. I wanted her to be sort of universal and someone that kind of many, many people, young people could connect to. So she felt just like the perfect person to do that, to be sort of the conduit of everyone's emotions.
I met her when she was a child and she came up to me at an event. I think she was probably 11 or something like that. She was maybe even younger than that. And she was like, Mr. Shyamalan, I like your movies. I would love to be in one of your movies. I was like, oh, that's so sweet, sweetheart. And to think about how the universe played out and that she was in a movie, but my daughter's movie.
It's so cool.
It's so beautiful. It's really beautiful because you must have been 2 or 3 at the time that the little Dakota came over.
That's crazy.
And then now to watch you two tell this story, it's so beautiful. Yeah, I agree that there's something otherworldly about Dakota and the way she holds emotions and the colors she chooses to tell the story of her life and her emotions, I think resonates. It's very much in alignment with, I think, their generation, but also Ashana in specific.
So what was it like working with Ashana and Knight on The Watched?
It was so lovely. I had met Knight once before when I was younger, but got to know him much better while making the film. And then, of course, working with Ashana and her directorial debut for, you know, in a feature film was so exciting. And it's such a creative family. And I think they've fostered Ashana's distinctive artistry and all of that. You know, she has so much to bring to this project, and adapting it and directing it, so inspiring and exciting to be around. And yeah, I'm happy to know them all.
Knight was telling me earlier that you had approached him as a child and said that you wanted to be in one of his films. Was that an aspiration for quite a long time, to be in a Shyamalan film?
Well, I don't remember that, but certainly I that was definitely true. I'm such a fan of his and his films. I feel like there should be a whole genre that's Shyamalan. I think he's created, you know, an entire genre almost. So I was thrilled to realize that dream that I didn't even know I had.
What did you like about the script for the film, about your character, Mina?
Well, I really liked that it was sort of a Irish fairy tale, very rooted in that folklore and the kind of mythological world that kind of still is very present in Ireland. I'd worked in Dublin before, so I was thrilled to get to go back because I have a lot of friends there. And then the character, I really liked how the real kind of humanness of the story is mixed with the kind of unreal, surreal elements, and like how they're kind of woven together. I found really cool and felt like it was something I hadn't really seen before. And the character Mina, I feel this kind of crossroads in her life, a bit of a standstill. She's still kind of searching and looking for something and running away from things in her past. Most people can relate to some version of that at one point or another in their lives. And so, you know, it kind of takes these strange, surreal circumstances to kind of lead her back to herself. And yeah, I found that, you know, kind of moving and inspiring and relatable. And then, of course, just, you know, loving the kind of magical nature of it all and the fairy tale of it all. So yeah, there were a lot of things I felt like I hadn't seen in a film before and felt like that were unique and that I hadn't done before either.
What was it like shooting in the Irish woodland?
Oh, it was wonderful. I love when you get to make the movie where it's actually set, you know? It's so, oftentimes you're in some random place and you're supposed to be, you know, in another. I thought it was really cool that we were actually there. We got to film in Galway a little bit and then mostly in the forest in Wicklow, and then the Coop set was on a stage, you know, right outside of Dublin. So it was very cool to have that real Irish feel in the film. And having worked there before, I have a lot of friends there, and there was some crew that I had worked with on the previous project that sort of overlapped with this one, so that was very nice, and it was familiar to me. So even though I was far from home, I didn't feel too lonely.
Owen Fuere, who's in the film with you, she's a bit of a genre veteran. Was there anything that she taught you while you were making the film?
Owen was so inspiring, I think, to all of us. She was like, wanted to do all of her stunts, everything. She was like running. She'd be like, you want me on the ground? And like, before you know it, she'd be like rolling around in the forest. We're like, Owen, you don't have to do that. But she was just kind of down for anything. And that was so fun to work with. And she, you know, of course, was super into the myth and keeping track of all of that. And I learned a ton from her and just enjoyed being around her, really enjoyed getting to know her.
Did you read the book by A.M. Shine, The Watchers, when you were preparing to come onto this film?
You know, I never read the books when I'm doing a movie if there's a book involved, because I think, you know, what you're really trying to do is the script. You know, that's what you're really trying to make. So I like to stay focused on the script, because sometimes there'll be, you know, things in the book that you're like, oh, that you'll be trying to do, but that's not really the script version of it, you know? So I try and stay in the world of the film that's being made and then revisit the book later. So I will read the book, but I kind of stay in the movie version of it. But met A.M. Shine. He came to visit the set, and he's so awesome and really cool guy. And I know he's was very excited by Ishana's adaptation. And we got to film in a pub in Galway where he wrote most of the novel, and that was very cool overlap. So, but I stay in the world of the script while I'm making it.
Were there any scenes that were particularly tricky or challenging to film?
There were a lot. I mean, I think, you know, we're filming in these forests that are quite, you know, can be a little disorienting. That was sort of helpful for the film. But the Coop set was one of the most unique sets I'd ever filmed on, just because it has such that large mirror, and so you're sort of performing on the stage for yourself. So you kind of have to get rid of anything self-conscious about you. You know, I think usually when you're acting, you're trying to like not think about what you look like and not think about what your face is doing or how your hair looks, and you're trying to let those things go. And then if you're acting in front of a mirror, you have to do a little bit more work to let those things go because you're staring at yourself. That was something that took a little bit of getting used to, but I think we all did. And I think it, and that set, in terms of like the cinematography, everyone had to get really creative with figuring out how to film in a small space, and especially with that mirror. And I think it really, yeah, pushed everyone to be as inventive as possible. So that's always fun to kind of have to push yourself out of your comfort zone.
So that was Ishana Knight Shyamalan, M. Night Shyamalan, and starred Dakota Fanning on The Watched. So, Lauren, I actually haven't seen this one yet. What did you actually make of the film?
I think it's an interesting one. Mm. You can definitely see the influence of M. Night Shyamalan's work on his daughter. I think Ishana's definitely gone for kind of horror, thriller genre. There's a lot of kind of folk horror in this with the setting. It's actually set in Ireland, and it's this Irish woodland that Dakota Fanning gets stranded in. And it's not just lost, it's a case of the power completely goes out. She's driving, the car stops, and she's stuck in these woods that she can't escape from. And it's got a really great cast aside from her. You've got Owen Fuere. She's in it as well as one of the other inhabitants of this cabin. She's not alone in the woods. There are other people trapped there, and they find that they have to stay there and allow themselves to be observed by some strange creatures that they don't know what they are. So that's where the horror from the film comes from.
Yeah, it's interesting because it feels so much like an M. Night Shyamalan film, just in terms of premise, doesn't it? And often when people have, like, you know, parents in the industry, they try and move away from it or kind of stake their own ground or whatever. But I mean, it very much feels like an M. Night Shyamalan premise almost, isn't it? Because of this unfolding mystery. But is it kind of satisfying? Is it scary?
No, I wouldn't say that it necessarily delivers on everything that it promises. I mean, it's very much been marketed as a horror film. The main thing is that they withhold the monsters from us. And when any film does that, all you want is by the end to have seen it in all its glory and it be cool. And it doesn't necessarily do that. You kind of see them kind of in silhouette or from a distance, but you never really get the proper horrifying monster moment that you really want from it.
Is it like a tense film? Did you find it kind of tense throughout? Or
it is, it has its suspenseful moments. You know, Mina's not just, Mina is Dakota Fanning's character in the film. She doesn't just sit around and accept her fate. She goes, you know, wandering around this forest looking for clues about what's going on. And there are some moments of suspense where she, you know, discovers some clues, or she discovers locations she shouldn't necessarily be in.
And are we very much following Mina the whole time, or Is it a kind of ensemble? Because Georgina Campbell was also in it, and she was kind of great in Black Mirror and Barbarian. So does she have much of a role in this?
She does have quite a good supporting role. I would say all the other characters, they have their own little bit of backstory that is explored. But I would say that it is Dakota Fanning's show, really. Her character has a bit of a mysterious past, as well as being stuck in her present predicament. And yeah, that's unveiled as well in flashback. And actually, speaking of that, that's kind of one of the problems I had with the film, is that there is a lot of character exposition, and then there's a lot of lore behind what the creatures are. I imagine the book must be quite hard to adapt, because there's also events that have happened before Mina comes into the picture that then the film has to kind of tackle in a way that's interesting. But it does end up being a lot of dialogue and a lot of info dumping. Even towards the end of the film, there's a little bit of a, maybe a bit of a twist. But even leading up to that, there's this dump of extra information to kind of set it up.
Sticking to the family tradition in that sense. a mixed bag then by the sounds of it, but do you think Aishana shows promise as a future director?
I think definitely. I mean, I think when you're in this line of work, you learn that it's so hard to even make a film in the first place, to get a film made. Hats off to her for making it and for adapting the source material, which she's clearly quite passionate about. And I think definitely there's obviously room for growth. You'll never judge anyone based on their first ever film. So I think I'm quite excited to see what she does next and how she develops as a filmmaker.
So if you fancy checking out the first film from Aishana Knight Shyamalan, that is The Watched, and that is in cinemas from Friday the 7th of June. And now time for this week's big streaming release.
No, 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 I don't buy it.
What?
You're not a hitman. You can't be. I tried looking you up and nothing. It's like you don't even exist.
I guess I'm just your fantasy.
So what's the biggest difference between the real you and your occupation?
By the way, my name is Gary Johnson, and I'm a fake hitman.
So this is Hitman, which is the new romantic thriller from director Richard Linklater. He's co-written this with Glenn Powell, who also stars as Gary Johnson. He's a mild-mannered lecturer who helps out the New Orleans Police Department with some of their undercover sting operations, but when Gary has to step in during one of their undercover encounters, he finds he actually has a real knack for playing the fictional hitman they're using to set up these would-be criminals. And before we review the film, we're going to hear from director Richard Linklater. And this is when online editor Emily Murray met up with him last week.
I realized not everyone fantasized about the same hitman. Every sting operation was a performance.
Oh. This is serious. I am in service business.
And each arrest was like a standing ovation.
Okay, Daniel Day.
I had it down to a science.
Sounds lovely.
Until things got, well,
Ron,
complicated.
Madison.
You know, I think movies invented hitmen. Fiction, it's a character we've created as a culture that just doesn't exist. It doesn't make any sense. You know, it'd be so easy to catch them. You've never heard of one being arrested, but people seem almost kind of saddened or offended that, like, oh, they don't exist? Like, we're all invested in it for some reason. We should be relieved they don't exist, but it's such a funny pop culture myth. So I love that part of it, but I also love, and I find darkly comedic, the desperate people who go on to think they're going to. I mean, I've listened to all these surveillance tapes. I've watched the sting operations, a lot of bad 90s, you know, 80s and 90s video, heard the recordings, and it's so bizarrely funny the way the clients start acting like they're in a crime movie. The line in the movie, all pie is good pie. People say, who made that up? I was like, that's a Gary Johnson line. You know, you can hear the people like, oh, we're going to meet at this little diner and how will you know it's me? I'll be eating pie in the corner and then come ask me, how's the pie? And I'll say, oh, you know, they think they're in a crime movie. Like suddenly everyone's playing their role. Like, oh, it's secret code. I'm dealing with the real deal here. It's like, oh, it's so sad. But we want to believe this stuff so bad, you know.
It's really hard trying to describe this film to like friends and family because it's so much because it's funny, but also it's dark. How did you find sort of balancing all the different tones and genres?
You know, you just go on a ride. You're trying to tell your story, and I never even think of what genre I'm in. I remember being pretty far into it going, I remember telling Glenn, like, this is kind of noirish. We're in the Double Indemnity body heat area here. And it's like, that's interesting, but we don't want to, you know, you can't do better than films like that. And then it's like, well, if they're meant to be, you know, if they're a great couple, like if we really say she's not setting him up to take the fall or anything like that, if what if they really do, what if they're really this great couple that's meant for each other? It's like, oh, then we're kind of a screwball comedy, you know, and it's like the notion of that is what's keeping the couple apart. You know, what's all the obstacles? And we got some pretty good obstacles in this movie. And then, you know, obviously we're in the hitman subgenre within the crime film. So it was a lot of genres kind of colliding and mashing up. But for me, that wasn't a challenge. It's always a tonal challenge. Mm. It was just perpetual, like, kind of dark comedy. you know, the world is dark. These people who want to kill people, you know, we can accept that that's dark. But yeah. Within that, you know, I think it's pretty funny, you know, has a lot of life to it.
Yeah, it's really funny. I like how it also explores sort of deeper themes like with identity. You know, can people change? Like, are we always trying to reconstruct our identity? Were you ever worried that it might be a bit too maybe surface level, but you couldn't dive deeper into it?
Not really. We had a kind of a great forum. When you have someone who's a lecturer of college students, you can get out there and you can sort of state your themes. Yeah. You can interact with that. So that was a good, I don't know if it's a narrative ploy or something, but everything he says is kind of on point to our themes, which is, you know, identity. It's these eternal questions like, hey, why am I who I am? Am I acting this role? And these are, you know, can I change? And 20 years ago, I would have said, no, we all kind of have our set points. That was my view. But I have read things more recently that suggest you can change. So this was an exploration of that. I'm like, can you change? How much can you change? And so it's fun to see. You go to movies to see people change or go through things. And, you know, so we're really watching in a funny way the evolution of a person from an introvert to an extrovert, from someone who's pretty dispassionate, someone who's pretty passionate. And you see them jump into the world, passionate, passion, love, sex. I mean, that can get you in trouble. Let's face it.
Yeah, it's a really sexy movie.
Yeah. It's really again, hot. That can get you in trouble.
Yeah. It's been interesting because I feel over the past few years, there's been a lot of conversation about sex scenes and sex in movies. And people are saying, cinema's not sexy anymore. Or do people want sex in cinema? How would you say Hitman plays into that conversation?
I make a joke. It's like, oh, yeah, the two think pieces that have been going on the last few years is like, oh, they're not really stars anymore. Does Hollywood not produce stars? And they don't have sex scenes in movie. All these superheroes, they don't have genitals, apparently. You know, it's just all so sexless and starless. And it's like, well, my old-fashioned movie is trying to address both of those points. So, yeah, here's my answer to that. But, you know, I guess Hitman is kind of an old-fashioned movie. Even while we were making it, I was going, it feels like an 80s movie, you know, just some kind of where the characters are really having sex, they're really driven by something, and, you know, something's going to happen because of it. But, you know what it is? It's been this slow infantilization, I guess, of cinema. The mainstream, the marketing departments that are greenlighting these things. I remember when I was a 13-year-old or a kid, they didn't make films for me so much. You know, I was watching adult movies, knowing I didn't get everything, but it was an intriguing world.
Yeah.
That's how life should be. Like, it was aspirational. I couldn't wait to be an adult. There seemed to be an element of freedom. There were certainly like fun things like sex and freedom and, you know, occupations. I'm like, wow, that I can't wait. But somewhere along the way, it's just like, you know, stay a kid forever. You know, just keep reading comic books. And, you know, we'll keep catering to your youth. Well, don't think about things like sex or the complexities of adulthood. Let's just simplify everything down. You know, like adult themes are complex. That's what makes them adult. That's what's intriguing. So they're complex in different ways to different people. So the more childlike you can be, probably the simpler it is and easier to sell maybe. So I don't know. That's Hollywood.
Yeah. It's interesting, Barry, that you mentioned about the movie star conversation as well, that like, are there movie stars anymore? Because I would say Glenn Powell is the answer.
Glenn Powell
to that.
Is absolutely a movie star, and everyone who's worked with him for the last 10 years absolutely knows that. But, you know, again, Hollywood's not sexless, childish movies. Those don't really make movie stars because you're playing a role like in a pre-existing character from some universe. You know, that's not what made stars. What made stars was like a personality, a strong, charismatic, star-driven personality that you follow them into whatever they do, you know, like Denzel Washington. Oh, I saw him in Glory. Oh, there's that guy. Like, what's he doing? I just want to watch him. Robert Redford, Paul Newman, you know, just everybody. Meryl Streep. You know, you follow stars. That's what made a star. So I don't know. There's probably a lot of dynamics that have changed that, but some paranoid part of me thought the industry would love stars to go away. They don't have to pay them so much. Yeah. They don't have, you know, Tom Cruise has a little too much power. You know, let's say we got to pay him too much when his films do so well. You know, let's just, can AI just play those parts? You know, that would be ideal probably.
Yeah. Well, it's been really exciting watching Glenn Powell's career rise. I feel like he's just signed on to like so many different projects now. Every day he has a new movie. Like, would you hope to work with him again soon?
Well, you can't believe all those sign-ups, because every time you have a meeting, if you're kind of hot, you just meet someone and talk about it. It's announced in the trades that you're doing something. So I'm friends with Glenn, and I haven't heard of most of those. The good thing is Glenn is that old-fashioned movie star who kind of came up through his hard work and his roles. He's not a part of some franchise yet. So I don't know. I think Glenn's a smart guy who's going to, you know, kind of the old school Warren Beatty, you know, the smart actor who's going to partner with the right people and take the right career choice. I hope that's what's in his future. And certainly we would like to work together again. We don't have anything just yet, but I'm sure something will evolve. We're fun creative partners.
I love the scene where he takes on all different disguises. Really shows like his range. Do you have a personal favorite or one that you're particularly drawn to?
Oh yeah, that was a fun element of the movie, because, you know, the real Gary Johnson did that. He would alter his appearance, and I think Glenn kind of went off the deep end with that. You know, we had that possibility to just go way out there with that stuff. And you can't be too over the top, because it's all fake anyway. My favorite, I'm a little partial to, they all had names, you know, not that the audience knows their names, but we had names for all of them. I like Dean, maybe the orange-haired, freckle-faced, weird guy. Like, he's the most otherworldly creature. He feels like an alien.
Yeah, I fear that he would probably be my hitman.
He would be, yeah. Like, that's who you'd want, this true weirdo psychopath guy who kills for pleasure. You know, he feels like, okay, I'll hire that. I'm in with a pro here, you know. So, but just because he's the most out there, but some of the other guys, I kind of love them all, you know.
I can't believe we're nearly out of time. I haven't even spoken about Madison yet, so I'm gonna ask about Madison.
Oh yeah, she's the secret, she's the movie.
She's amazing, and I think it's really interesting, her character, because we meet her in a darkest moment. It'd be so easy to sort of make her really unlikable or really dangerous or Black Widow. So was she quite a difficult character to write?
Yeah, Adria is just, I just think she's such a unique, special talent. I mean, just meeting her, like this was, I knew that would be the part. You know, you get that wrong, you don't have a movie. I was like, God, who can play this? And I remember meeting her, and I was like, oh my God, she's perfect. I think the biggest quality would be, I mean, she's so smart, funny, vivacious, all that. But it's like, oh, would you risk everything you've, I told casting, it's like, would you risk your freedom and everything you've worked for? Would you throw it all away to be with her? You know, so it's like, yeah, I think she fits that. She fits that bill. So I think people could relate. The difference is Gary Johnson was a real person. We had a lot of reference there. You know, what he was doing. She was, since we kind of, there was this woman he let off, but from then on, we had to really create her. So it was great to get a creative partner like Adria, who came in and really knew that character, who brought so many levels of mystery to her. And she was always a step ahead. She knew what she wanted and did, you know. So there's no replacing like smart, you know, working with really intelligent actors who are not only good actors, but like hardworking and intelligent. Those are good qualities and funny. So I don't know. I was just so happy with Glenn and Adria. They work so hard and were really good, you know, partners on this.
So that was Richard Linklater. And yes, this is Hitman, which is a film that has briefly had a cinema release in the UK. It's also done a big round of festivals, having appeared at, it premiered at Venice, and then it was at TIFF, and it's been at the London Film Festival. So it feels like it's had quite a long festival life almost, and now it's finally here on Netflix. Just to dive straight in, I'd say like I found this film like massively entertaining. Sort of, it was mentioned briefly on the podcast a couple of weeks back when it did get that cinema release. But yes, I'm a big Richard Linklater fan anyway. He's sort of one of my favourite directors. It's his most crowd-pleasing film, I'd say, for quite a long time. And it's just one of those films that's just, to me anyway, immensely enjoyable, just super easy to watch. A fun, cool concept, very charismatic star. And he also has like really great chemistry with Adria Arjona. And then they form a connection and it turns into a bit of a romance from there, but obviously a very complicated one given the nature of his undercover lies and the fact he's not quite who she thinks he is. And things get sort of ever more complicated from there. But yes, I just found it immensely enjoyable to watch. Like, how did you find it?
Yeah, it's absolutely Glenn Powell's film, though, isn't it? He's not just playing one hitman. He develops multiple alter egos depending on the kind of would-be criminal that he's trying to trying to get arrested. And he plays just basically so many caricatures of so many cinematic hitmen. And it's hilarious. I think Glenn Powell's massively talented.
It's very much like his time at the moment, isn't he? He's very much the man of the moment. After Anyone But You being like a big hit. And obviously he really exploded in Top Gun. And have you seen Everybody Wants Some that he did with Richard Linklater previously? But he was kind of a supporting character in that, but he really stood out in that. And he has a tiny voice role in Richard Linklater's Apollo 10 and a half animation, which also actually went to Netflix. But I absolutely loved that film. But that made a much smaller splash, really. It just seemed to go straight to Netflix and went largely unnoticed. Whereas Hitman does feel like it's built up a lot of steam with all of its festival premieres and things. But it feels like Glenn Powell's kind of been building to this. And it's impressive that he obviously co-wrote this script as well. And it is very loosely based on a true story as well. And they joke about it a bit in some of the credits in the film. But what I really liked about it is it's fun. There's genuine sort of chemistry between Glenn Powell and Adria Arjona, which you always want in a film, but you don't always get. So there's genuine chemistry there between them two. It's like an intriguing mystery, and things do get quite knotty and complicated and tense because there's this other kind of cop in the picture, Jasper, who's played by Austin Emilio. He has this kind of rivalry with Gary, and when Gary kind of takes his place effectively as the go-to undercover hitman, so he's kind of looking to get rid of Gary as well. So there's all this kind of tension going on there. And it's also one of those films that it's very easy just to watch on a Friday night, but there is some sort of philosophical stuff going on there as well, isn't there, about the roles we play in life, you know, and who we are. So it's one of those films that, like with a lot of Richard Linklater's films, you actually come away with a fair bit to think about and sort of chat about afterwards, don't you? Despite also just being able to just have a really good time with it.
Yeah, it kind of asks the question about identity and whether we are who we are and that's set in stone, or whether you can simply choose to become someone else and kind of take on different qualities.
And it kind of ties into his role as a philosophy professor as well in his day-to-day life. You know, we see little moments of him in the sort of in the lecture halls where he's playing with some of these ideas, and it's just a really good film.
I'm a massive film noir fan. Mm. And I really like how the direction it goes off in, with him falling in love with a woman who's trying to order a hit on her husband, is very noirish. But I think the one thing I would say, I really enjoyed it overall, but I think the direction it goes in, perhaps it ought to take itself a bit more seriously.
Yeah,
in places.
I've seen this twice now because I saw it at the London Film Festival. That was when I first saw it, and I rewatched it again recently ahead of this. And I found that the ending went down slightly better for me on the second viewing, because I was a bit almost taken aback by the ending the first time. And it does go to quite dark places in a way, for all its kind of light, frothy, easy to watch nature. It does go to some quite dark places, and that threw me a bit. And it's also one of those strange films. I get this with films occasionally, that despite going about how much I loved it, I would still say it's like a 4-star film, if you know what I mean. It doesn't quite break the 5-star ceiling. But that said, I feel like it's one of those films I'll revisit and watch a lot more than a lot of 5-star films of the last couple of years, just because it's just so entertaining to watch. And it's the kind of film that I feel like you could almost recommend it to anyone. That's how it feels to me, at least, that any kind of friend or whatever, I just would just sort of indiscriminately recommend it, just because I think it's just so easy to watch. They're both so kind of charismatic as the leads. And yeah, and just because, like I say, because you can watch it, you can kind of almost get as much out of it as you want, really, can't you? And that you can just watch it as this, yeah, a fun, noir-y. It's got kind of screwball elements as well, I think, in their relationship and in terms of like the changing power dynamics and not always knowing exactly what's going on. So you can just enjoy it on that level, but then you can, like, you could easily go and have a good like pub chat afterwards, go and get some pie afterwards and mull it over.
Or cake. Oh no, it is pie. All pie is good pie.
Yes, all pie is good pie. And that was very much stuck in my head afterwards. So if you do fancy catching that is Hitman, and that is streaming on Netflix from Friday. And now, a return to the Old West.
Can I have your attention, ladies and gentlemen? I am Sergeant Webb of the California Regiment. We need volunteers. We want to fight to save the Union. We're looking for men of honor.
Thinking about enlisting.
This is not your problem. This is not your country.
It's the right thing to do, fighting against slavery.
We have a life together now. It is only beginning.
be my wife.
You cannot make things right with a consolation prize.
No sense being all alone on a night like this.
No different than any other. I am fine, Mr. Jeffries.
No, you most certainly are.
So this is The Dead Don't Hurt, which is the latest film from Viggo Mortensen as director and star. And before we review the film, we're going to hear from Viggo and his co-star Vicky Creeps from when Lauren caught up with them this week.
It makes no sense for you to be here now, Weston.
Is it going to be a problem, Mr. Schiller?
I don't believe so, Alfred. I shouldn't have left.
I never wanted to be saved.
So to start at the beginning, I suppose, Viggo, what inspired the story of The Dead Don't Hurt?
Vivian, and before that, my mother, really. Personality of the character Vicky plays, you know, the little girl and then the adult she becomes. Her personality is similar to my mother's, you know, someone who's essentially an ordinary person, you know, in the case of my mother, a woman of her time, a mother of three boys and, was a housewife, but she had other interests, was read a lot, was interested in other cultures and curious about people and loved going to the movies. She took me to the movies. She was the first person I went with, and all through her life we would go to the movies and talk about the stories, you know. And she had a lot of really great ideas and great memory for details in movies and opinions about directors and all that. I think in another life maybe she would have been a screenwriter or a director. And this character Vivian is how it started, and then I thought it'd be interesting to put her in the West in the 19th century.
So how did you two first meet?
We met once. You sent me the script, I think, and I said I would be interested. And then we met for coffee with my son. I had my son with me. Yeah, we just met once I had read the script.
What made Vicky so well suited to playing Vivian?
She's a great actress. Not just technically good, but there's something else going on. And you don't always understand exactly what, but there's definitely something going on. That's what I saw, you know, before meeting her. And I like that. I like that. That's why you can't take your eyes off her. She's on screen, even if it's a small part. You like, what's going on with this person? What are they thinking about?
It's so funny. One of my first castings I ever had when I started, I didn't get the role. And the reason was I was in Germany. I didn't do well in Germany, by the way. They never really understood me. But I will always remember I do the casting and I'm thinking that went really well, you know, and I really felt it and I think I wasn't that bad, but that was the problem. So then they said to me, you know, the problem is, because I wasn't there for the main character, I was like the supporting character, said, problem is, you're someone, if you open the door, the people wonder what's wrong with her, what's going on with this woman, but you're just there to introduce to the main character, you know, people cannot.
And we want to pay attention to the main character, not yeah, just to you.
You cannot get stay stuck with your problem.
No, but there's something going on, yeah. You know, and in a way it's unfair. There are actors who are incredible on stage, really technically good, and then you see them on film and they're really good, they do the parts really well, and sometimes they give them awards and everything, but there are a handful of people. It's never that many who have something extra. It's hard to define. And I say unfair. Sometimes people that work for long careers and are excellent actors, yeah, and they just don't have that. You're not wondering what they're thinking. Yeah. You're just like, okay, that was nice. Okay, what's the other person saying? Even as the other person's starting to talk, I'm still looking at this person. Because what's going on there? Something's happening.
Yeah.
There's something being transmitted even in silence. You know, the way they listen, the way they react to their environment, there's something extra happening. And Vicky definitely has that. When I first saw you in The Phantom Thread, I know comparisons are odious, but I thought, this, what I feel that she's transmitting, almost like through her skin or something, is how I felt when I saw Meryl Streep, the first couple of movies I saw her in years ago. And I was like, wow, there's that similar inner strength that comes through.
And Vicky, what did you like about the character and about the script?
It was almost like there was something about the film that was more than just me doing that character, you know. I was thinking, actually, when we first met, the funny thing is that I told him, okay, so I was in Arizona, I was shooting a film, every day my set was the desert, and one day I thought, I should be on a horse. It feels really wrong to be in a car. And I thought about the wars, all the many wars that have been done over that piece of land. Having done Corsage, I felt like that would be an appropriate environment to fight for, I don't know, whatever it is I'm fighting for. maybe honesty or something from women. And the same week or a week later, I received the email with Vigo's script. So from the beginning, you see, there was some sort of evidence of me doing that film, not only, you know, because I was a fan of Vigo, but at that point, I hadn't seen your first film that you directed. I'd seen all your other films you acted in. Something else. It was not just, okay, do I want to be part of this? It was like something was calling me and I have to go.
And you're wearing a lot of hats when you're making this, Vigo. You're directing, you've written it, you're producing, starring, composing the score. What draws you towards taking on all of those jobs, and what's it like to do that?
Well, what I like most about making movies is that it's actually a team sport, you know, the collaborative aspect of it. And, you know, there's other stories I've written, and hopefully I'll get to direct someday, and where I probably won't do the music. But in this case, I had a really clear idea of what it should be. And then I started working with the musicians that play, you know, Cameron Stone and Scarlett Rivera, Travis Dickerson, you know, I started working with them. And that was a collaboration. You know, I had these themes, I had these melodies I'd come up with, and then we worked on them, and they evolved in a, you know, collective way.
Usually, this is quite a subversive Western in a way, in that usually if a man goes off to war in a film, we follow him and you have the battle scenes and things like that. Why is it important, do you think, that we stay with Vivienne during this film when your character goes off to war?
Well, she's the main character, you know. She's the one whose childhood we see. But I also was just curious, personally, as an audience member, I hadn't really seen that in Westerns or really in other genres either. So normally, if the man goes off to war, you got to see that. That's the main event. And I thought, well, what do the little girls do when their dads go to war? What do the women do when their partners or their brothers or their sons even go off to war? What are the consequences? How do they survive? And how does it affect them psychologically and physically, you know? I just wanted to explore that. I thought it would be interesting to investigate that together with Vicky and other people.
And Vicky, what was it like to work with Vigo as a director?
I mean, it was a great experience to working just as with the director. Like, it would have been another film, another director situation where you wouldn't have been also the actor. I would have enjoyed that experience. But here it was even more complex because there was the director-actor relationship, then there was the actor-actor relationship. And what Vigo just said, he's very much in love with the teamwork. So he's very invested in every single department, every single detail, and nothing is for free. And I'm more like, I think as a person, I'm very empathetic, but when I make a movie, I become quite self-centered in a way. And in order to do what I do, which only happens once you see the film, where you feel it comes through my skin and it feels very generous, in order to do that when I'm on set, I can become quite closed or stubborn with ideas or, you know. That was for me not always easy to learn and understand that I have to share the director, but I also have to share the actor with everyone. When I knew I had to share the actor with, you know, the rest of the crew, because now that the actor was, as the director, talking to the camera, I started talking to the furniture or
to stay in the moment.
Yeah, that was only there for me, you know, so I stayed in the moment and I wouldn't start thinking about, did he like the scene as a director, you know, but try and really focus on Vigo as the actor.
And then it was probably different, I guess, when you were acting and I was only directing, that was probably different then, right?
Like, yes, exactly. So then it felt more like just a normal directing, acting relationship. Mm-hmm. That was much easier.
When you were writing the script, Vigo, did you always know that you were going to play Holger?
No, I wasn't intending to. And another actor was cast. And in the end, he ended up not being able to do it. But it was not long before we were going to shoot. So I couldn't find someone to replace him that was of the same type or that was right for the character. They just weren't available. And so that's how it sort of happened, more or less by accident. But now, unless you bring it up, I see the movie and it makes sense that Vivian and Olson are together, and it makes sense the kind of relationship he has with the boy and his previous military experience. It just makes sense now. The way we ended up making adjustments so that relationship would work, I don't question it now. I don't think, it's too bad that he wasn't different or younger or something else. It just feels like this is the story now.
So the character changed quite a lot.
Well, the character became older automatically. And I thought, well, what does that mean if he's older? Well, that means he could have been in previous wars. And that was an added thing that helped the story. And there's a certain attitude. He's been through certain things. Yeah. He's lost a life partner already some years ago. And he still probably feels the consequences of that. And so he's accepted that he's probably going to just be a person that lives on their own. He's curious about people, but he likes to be by himself. Vivienne and Olsen, at the moment they meet, even though they're different ages, but they've been through lots of things, both of them separately on their own. I don't think either of them are looking for a life partner. That's my impression. It sort of happens. It's unexpected for both of them. You know, it's like an attraction. And even when that happens, it's like, well, let's see. Even that moment, even I think the morning after, where she looks at him and goes, well, he's kind of clumsy. Maybe I can get rid of him. You know, and she tries, and he sort of doesn't want to leave. And then she thinks, well, he's got some balls, and let's see what happens here. Maybe I can have some fun with him. She's kind of mischievous, and so she does that. Yeah. But I think they enjoy being around each other. They amuse each other, and they're curious about what the other person thinks and feels. It's like, I haven't met someone quite like this, you know? But I don't think either of them expect this to be a long relationship at that point. It just sort of happens naturally.
Watching Viggo take on all those roles, directing his own film, starring in it, do you think that's something that you might ever want to do yourself?
Maybe the opposite. I could definitely tell a story, and I have millions of stories in my head, and people ask me that often. And I think I know where it comes from. It's because when I'm acting, I'm also thinking, you know, I can't help it. I always think of the story and even more and the meaning of the film, but it's like almost unconscious. I don't know if I would be able to direct, you know, in the sense that there's all these people you have to talk to and almost like a football team. I don't know if I'm maybe too sensitive for that. I don't know.
And how does it feel to have the film be so well received so far?
That's great.
Yeah, it's a relief. I mean, we worked really hard on it. It's a story that we feel we got the most out of the time we had and did it well. And then when you're writing first by yourself, at least in my case, I'm writing something that I want to see. And I'm not thinking if anybody else wants to see it. I'm not adjusting what I'm writing. Oh, I want to, this is fashionable right now, or I think this will, people will like this, or women will like this story about a woman. I just was interested in writing about this woman and what happens to her. And then she meets this guy and what happens there. And you know, step by step for myself. And then you make the movie and it's even better than I hoped it would be. So I'm happy. And it seems like the team is happy. And then you hope that someone else will like it. And it's been really nice. I mean, we've already presented it in France and Spain, and we've shown it in the US, and we've shown
people
it here.
People really relate to her and this human side, and this is what I'm really happy about. It's not just that people like it because they go, another good film. They really honestly relate to that woman who's in the Wild West, but she's just a woman, you know, and for once it's not like, I don't know what we see nowadays, but you know, like Sex and the City, where you think, okay, every woman is only interested in finding a man and being either married or not married. You know, women don't think about that all the time. Women very well also just live a life.
So that was Viggo Mortensen and Vicky Creeps. Lauren, do you want to sort of set this film up a bit more for us?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to mention is how many hats Viggo Mortensen is wearing on this production. He's not just written and directed it, he's also the producer, he stars in it, and he's composed the score as well, which isn't the first time he's composed the score for his films, which is really interesting and I imagine a lot of hard work. And so, yes, he stars as Holger, who is a Danish immigrant living in the US in the 1860s. And he meets and falls in love with Vicky Creeps' Vivienne, who is French-Canadian, I believe. And yeah, it's really a very traditionally made film that really explores their relationship and their life together over the years until they are eventually separated by the American Civil War, where Holger goes off to fight and Vivienne is left on her own at home. But that's the really interesting thing about The Dead Don't Hurt, is that usually if a man goes off to war in a film, you would follow him and there'd be the big battle scenes and what have you. But this actually stays with Vicky Creeps and her character, who's very sort of fiery and modern for a woman of that time period. And that's a really interesting part of the film.
Talking of like festivals, this was another one that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and I really liked it. And I haven't seen it since then, so my memory is a little bit hazy on it, but I did really enjoy it. And yeah, one, it's just crazy. Viggo, just a real multi-hyphenate in terms of is there anything he can't do? I don't know. It has a sort of flashbacky structure, doesn't it, as well? Yeah, we kind of open at a certain point and then we jump back in time a bit and then we end up going back to that point
near the end,
yes,
and then it tells the story from the beginning but with scenes from the end kind of interspersed in there.
And I was almost going to drop a sort of spoiler, but then it happens very early on, but I won't mention it anyway. But It's very interesting the way it plays out. I really liked their relationship and their chemistry, and they kind of build this home together, which I just liked seeing that all come together and the way they were with each other. And it's interesting, like you mentioned, that obviously Viggo's character then just does go out of the film for quite a while. So in some ways, Vivian is the main character almost of this film. It's interesting because it does have a lot of it has all the trappings really of the kind of classic Western that you expect, but it is kind of subversive in its own way in terms of what it chooses to focus on, and I suppose the kind of feminist angle that it takes compared to a lot of Westerns that would have traditionally seen.
Yeah, Vivian's a really likable character, I think, or at least I found her really likable. Yes. In that she's kind of beholden to no one, doesn't want to be owned or controlled, and she wants to have her own freedom and her own money and her own life. And that's something that Holger really supports, but other men in the film don't. And that makes her a really compelling protagonist.
And it's quite like stately in its pace, isn't it, as well? So it's not like, I mean, in terms of it being like a modern Western, it's not like, it's not a fast-paced film or anything like that. I mean, you kind of wouldn't expect that from Viggo anyway. But if you sort of give yourself over to that, I really sort of enjoyed that slow pace, and you can take in this amazing scenery as well and all these sort of landscapes. But if I had a couple of qualms, there's one kind of baddie character in it who's played by Solly McLeod, the character's Weston Jeffries, and he's the son of this corrupt local. And I thought he was a bit one note.
I actually quite liked him. I thought, yes, it's one note, but it's really traditional, horrible villain. And he does get very nasty.
Yeah, he certainly makes you hate him. He does that very effectively, I thought. And another thing which just struck me as odd is I counted three supporting actors who had appeared in Deadwood. So that just kind of almost took me out of it a bit, because, I mean, that's obviously one of the biggest Western stories of recent years. But that sort of slightly took me out of it. But on the whole, I actually really enjoyed it. And again, it's this genre that was obviously just such a huge genre in the history of cinema that we really don't see that much these days. So I thought this was a really nice return to the Western and a slightly different spin on it. So if you do fancy checking that out, that is The Dead Don't Hurt, which is in cinemas from Friday. Now for our final film this week.
Boys,
if you're seeing this, I'm probably dead.
Whoever gave the order to kill me is in the department. They're coming after you next.
You should be careful. Your people want you dead.
We're being framed.
It's just us, no backup.
So this is Bad Boys Ride or Die. Lauren, do you want to briefly set up this for anyone who isn't up to speed with the Bad Boys franchise?
Okay, well, this is the second Bad Boys film directed by the duo Adil and Bilal. And this follows the Bad Boys, Will Smith and Martin Lawrence, playing the detectives Mike Lowry and Marcus Burnett. And this time, they're on the run themselves.
That's the twist this time around.
The twist that was in the trailers. But yes, they have to clear their names, as well as the name of the deceased Captain Conrad, who died in the third film, Bad Boys for Life. He's now been pinned to the drug cartels operating in Miami, even though he is innocent, or the Bad Boys are convinced he's innocent. So they set out to clear his name and end up getting into a fair bit of trouble themselves.
Did you actually enjoy this film?
I did. I enjoyed it. I think I went in thinking this is going to be fun and a bit silly, and that was exactly as it was.
Yeah, because I'm not the biggest fan of the franchise in the sense that I've seen them all and I can't really remember any of them that well, even including the most recent one, which I sort of had a similar kind of time to this. And this is the one that's kind of the direct sequel to, obviously, and it is in keeping with that because it's Adil and Bilal that you mentioned directing. But I probably, from my limited memory, I enjoyed this one a bit more, I think, in that feels like it knows it's silly. It feels like it's just knows what it's got to do. It doesn't try to be anything that it's not. And it just leans into the two characters and their bantering relationship. And in this one, we kind of find that early on in the film, like right at the beginning, Will Smith's Mike is getting married and him and Marcus are heading there. And basically, it's just, I thought that whole scene was very funny, like the kind of delays they have along the way. And then Marcus ends up having basically a heart attack at the wedding and this near-death experience. And so he comes back very, very kind of zen, having had this seemingly taste of the afterlife. There's these weird, the last couple of films, I mean, to my memory, they didn't do this in the first couple of films, but I haven't seen them since around the time they came out. So I can't say with absolute certainty. But yeah, so there's weird spiritual elements to this one. And there were weird kind of, there's a character who's referred to as a witch in the last film. So there were weird kind of mythological elements sort of brought into what is mostly just a broad action comedy. So I found that aspect of it quite funny. And I liked that shook their dynamic up a little bit, this experience that Marcus has had. It's kind of non-stop as well, really, isn't it? It just kind of gets going. It feels like a throwback in that sense, that just the way you kind of briefly described the plot earlier with the cartels and the setups and all that kind of thing. It just feels like a throwback to that type of action film, and they're just basically going from one scene to the next, sort of shooting with abandon. they get to a point where loads of different factions are after them, basically from both sides of the law. There's also as well, if I had, you know, one kind of criticism I'd have of the film is that there's perhaps a few too many characters in the mix, because they bring back a couple of characters from For Life, including Vanessa Hudgens and Alexander Ludwig, who are like fellow law enforcement. I don't know exactly what part of the law enforcement they fall into, but they're these kind of special ops kind of cops, I suppose, who are on their team. And they were the sort of young blood brought in last time. So they're brought back in. And then Jacob Scipio is back as Mike's son, who is his kind of like long lost son that he didn't realize he had, that we discovered in the last film. So he's in the mix as well. And then you've got like different levels of kind of bad guy. So there is a lot going on. And there's several odd cameos as well.
Oh. Odd or wonderful? I think some of those were really enjoyable. Yeah. But I think, speaking of the film being non-stop, the camera does not stop moving. Yeah. I thought for a moment that Michael Bay had returned to direct, because I was having ambulance flashbacks with how much the camera moves around everything all the time.
Do you know what? I saw your tweet about that after the screening, and I was going to mention that because I actually didn't mind it. I could see that there was one moment where there's just like a little family reunion moment and the camera's just spinning around them. And I felt a bit dizzy then. But on the whole, I kind of went along with it, just because I thought there were some moments that were quite stylishly done like that for some of the sort of gunplay and action scenes. For me, it worked with the over-the-top energy of the whole film in a way. But I can see why it'd be a bit much, because it's just always whizzing around. And always whizzing around, always at high speed.
But the action scenes themselves are actually really crowd-pleasing and really satisfying. It's funny. It's a funny film tonally, because one minute it's completely taking the mickey out of itself, and the next minute you've got this very well choreographed action sequence that's just brilliant. And it feels like it kind of, rather than perhaps get the tone right in balancing the two at the same time, it kind of swings between them.
Yeah, and because it's odd, because it has some really broad humor and some really just very silly moments, but then it does have some real kind of violence as well. And there's one scene where there's this fight in a prison yard and they're using kind of weights and kettlebells, things like that, and that it was really quite wince inducing some of that, seeing people being like smashed around with those. It basically just throws everything at the screen, so it even briefly turns into like a creature feature at one point. And it's one of those films that, yeah, like, it's just not one that I will ever particularly revisit again, or that I'll ever particularly think about in years to come. But I must admit, I was entertained throughout the runtime. So it's just in terms of big silly fun. Unlike, say, Hitman, I'd say there's not really that much going on deeper. And it's a bit one of those kind of like, you know, candy floss where it's like sweet, light, you kind of, you know, forget about it instantly afterwards. Like even now, I'm sort of, things have blurred in my mind. Did that happen in this film or the previous one? But I must admit, I was smiling quite a lot throughout this film.
Yeah. I think the one thing that really comes across is the chemistry between Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. It kind of comes across that they would be happy to just keep making these films forever and ever and not really lose that banter between them.
And there's Ethan as well. It just made me laugh that there's someone who I won't name them, but we both sort of said this afterwards, that as soon as you see their kind of cast in it, you just know they're going to be up to no good, basically. So that just made me laugh as well. It's very like straightforward, but sometimes if you're actually in the mood for that, which you often are, it sort of hit the spot in the moment, definitely. So that is Bad Boys Ride or Die, which is in cinemas now. So Lauren, what would you say your film or show of the week is this week?
I think I would have to say The Acolyte. I'm a big Star Wars fan and I'm a big sci-fi person. So it was kind of edging towards the top anyway. But I think it's really intriguing so far. And I really like the characters and I really like how it's doing something different for a Star Wars show. So yeah, I'm really keen to see how that develops.
Yeah, I haven't seen The Watched, obviously, at this point. But for me, I'd have to pick Hitman just because I did just enjoy it so much. But I also, you know, rate The Dead Don't Hurt highly and very keen to carry on with The Acolyte too. So plenty of interesting stuff to watch this week. But we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Our Twisters issue is still out, which you may have seen, or if not, you can find that in the shops or pick it up digitally. And if you take out a subscription, you will now get instant digital access to that issue and loads more in our huge archive of back issues. So if you fancy signing up, there will be a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe on your podcast app of choice. And nice reviews are always welcome too. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or visit or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question. Lauren, who is your favourite movie hitman?
That's an incredibly difficult question because there are so many of them that are fantastic. But I think towards the top definitely has to be Tom Cruise as Vincent in Michael Mann's Collateral. Mm. Just so cold and calculating, but also so scarily polite. What about you?
Yeah, what a film. I haven't seen that for years, but I loved that film when it came out. And nice to see Cruise doing something very different there as well. Yeah, so Gary Johnson will probably be high up in my favourite hitmans in years to come. But off the top of my head, I'm just going to go for Martin Q. Blank, played by John Cusack in Gross Point Blank. Just because Jamie Graham, often of this podcast, tweeted about it and made me really want to revisit it because it's just such a great film. And again, it's just one of those films, I don't know anyone who doesn't like that film. And it perhaps doesn't get mentioned enough these days. And scarily is like over 25 years old now. Great film and like a very different kind of hitman. Because I mean, there's just so many great hitmen in the history of film that it's a tough category to nail down. But that was based, thanks to Jamie's tweet, that was front of my mind. So I'm going for Martin Q. Blank.
I actually haven't seen Gross Point Blank, but it's now on my list.
Yes, you must check it out. That's all from us this week, so thanks very much for listening, and until the next one, goodbye.
Goodbye. What you gonna do when they come for you?